Welcome to Recurring Nightmares, Episode 2. I am Chris, as always, joined by Jeff.
Hello!
This is, it's our second Recurring Nightmares, but as some of you know, we did quite a lot of episodes of Movie Dudes. We're back with this new show, slightly new format, where we are going to pick two movies, review them both. They don't have to be a original and a remake. So that happens to be the current trajectory that we are on with these first two episodes. But at some point, it'll just have to be related in some way, tangentially, maybe.
Yep. Trust me, next month will not be.
So we're getting there. Just so happened that the first two we picked kind of went that path, that way. And but before that, we're gonna kind of like go over some things we've been watching over the last month. I have not watched a lot other than these two movies, but we'll get into that. Jeff, what have you been watching?
I've been watching a bunch of stuff. I'd say a lot of TV. Have you heard of a show called Dave?
That's one I have on my list. On my very short list.
Oh, that was one of the two things?
And I finished Dave today.
Oh, did you? All right, yeah. So let's talk about Dave instead of me just running down all my stuff.
Yeah.
What'd you think?
It's all right. Maybe I went in with super high expectations for it. You hyped it up quite a bit. It's like it took me a little while to kind of get invested in the main character. I guess we should explain what Dave is, right?
Yeah,
White rapper.
Yeah, and it's played by a guy who in real life is a white rapper named Little Dicky, and it's one of those like half hour comedy shows where the person starring in the show is kind of playing theirself, you know?
Right.
And so I guess for me, I was a huge fan of Little Dicky when he first came out like 7 years ago, to like the point where I even emailed him and he responded and shit.
In that 15 minutes of fan interaction.
Yeah. Yeah. And so like, I've been kind of like rooting for this guy forever. And I think he's like kind of, I mean, I thought he was very, I think he's very talented as a rapper, but I think he's kind of found his thing with this. This show was very successful. They greenlit a second season. And so, yeah, I think I had a little more invested in wanting to like this, but I also, like, it's pretty rare for me to, like, get into a half-hour comedy. Like, just doesn't, a lot of the big ones I miss, just because it's just not my, like, I like my hour-long dramas with cops and killing and all that stuff.
Right.
And I think the show is, like, both pretty smart and really funny. Like, there's parts of the show that, there's a roadkill scene near the end of the season that had me dying.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
He, like, hits a bunny rabbit?
A bunny, yeah.
Yeah, and it's, like, still alive, and his girlfriend wants him to, like, put it out of its misery. And just the way, like, the whole thing plays out, like, I could just see me reacting how he does, or I'm like, I don't want to kill it. There's a scene early on in the season, I won't spoil it, but it involves a milking table, and if you don't know what that is, don't look it up, just watch the show.
Yeah, don't look it up.
That made my girlfriend laugh so fucking hard. Like, she was howling for minutes, and she'd stop, and then she'd start laughing again, so, I don't know.
It's a very funny scene. I did not react quite that same way, but it is.
I mean, I thought it was very funny. I'm sorry, what did you say, Chris?
It's a good capper to that episode.
Oh, yeah. The whole episode is really fun. It's like him and his girlfriend exploring their kinks, and it's like her asking him like what kind of porno, like what categories he watches. I don't know.
They bring that table back.
Yeah. I don't know. So I like the dude to begin with, but I do think that they did a good job on the show.
Yeah, I mean, there's some heart with it. Like, the character, I don't necessarily like Dave himself all that much. Like, and I'm not entirely sure you're supposed to. He is a bit narcissistic, and
I'm a genius, and
yeah, he's kind of a dick to, like, all of his friends, and but his friends, the ones that are, you know, surrounding him, are hysterical, and they keep him grounded in a good way. That, you know, there's some realism there. It's not your typical sitcom.
I do think, I guess, I don't want to spoil this for people that haven't seen it, but I do think that the season ended on, like, a really cool note, where it was like, who are you? Are you Dave? Are you Little Dicky? Or whatever. And I think that the way it ends kind of answers that.
Well, I mean, then that, like, the way it ended, I was like, one, I kind of wanted a little more, because, like, he turns a corner.
Yeah, yeah. And, that's how you do it, baby. You leave people wanting, you know? Yeah, like,
all right, like, it, you know, there's some stuff that happens relationship-wise with him, and he's kind of being a dick to his best friends, and, you know, he has to make a choice, and he does, and it's like, all right, well, now I kind of want to see, like, where this goes, because it's been built up around him being, like, one type of person, and he finally realizes something else, and, but yeah, it's a, you know, what was it, 10 episodes, 8 episodes, something like that?
They're all really short, too, so, I forgot what else I was going to say about it, but we shouldn't probably spend too much time on one thing. I got, like, a bunch of stuff, so.
Yeah, I mean,
if
you like comedies, you know, more serious comedies, I would say, because it's not necessarily it's not a family sitcom, you know, it's not Fresh Off the Boat or Fuller House or something like that. It's more serious.
It's a little like, I don't know. It's a very funny show, but it's a little smarter than just like a normal
sitcom. Yeah. I think it's worth giving the few hours over to it to see the journey. It did grip me at least at some point.
Well, I'm happy you at least weren't like, what the fuck was that? This is one that I pushed. I hate when I push someone on something and then they come back and they're like,
that was terrible.
Yeah.
So what else have you been watching?
Also in the TV realm, The Last Dance on ESPN, which was kind of a big thing culturally, like while it was airing.
Yeah, it seemed like everybody except me watched it. So.
Yeah, and I wonder, it's interesting because, like, when I watched it, like, I'm watching it from the perspective of as someone who, like, grew up in Chicago, and so it's like, the Bulls in the 90s were, like, the biggest thing ever. Like, there's no escaping it. Like, you know, I have memories of when they won, when all this shit happened that the documentary covers, you know, I remember it from a Chicago fan's perspective, you know? So it's like, I don't even know, like, what, like, you know, people who live in, you know, Philly, like, what they think of the 90s Bulls or what they think of Jordan. Like, do they think he's the greatest of all time, or are they just like, fuck that guy?
Jordan is,
I don't know,
considered the greatest of all time, or at least, you know, in the conversation, most people would probably say yes, though.
But it's like, do you, and people you know, like, view him like, I wonder if, like, people view him like Tom Brady, like, where I'm like, fuck Tom Brady, fuck the Patriots, or is there actual respect?
I remember growing up and, like, people, like, idolizing him. Like, you go to the basketball court and like, people are, like, everybody's, like, trying to, like, you know, do the layup with the tongue out and
the Air Jordans.
So it's definitely not, like, the Tom Brady thing. I do think, though, that the perception on him has changed. Like, publicly, I don't know that, and I don't even know that our generation idolizes him in the same way anymore. Like, they respect him as a player, but we didn't have the access to, you know, social media that a lot of these players have now.
Yeah, they talk about that a little in the show, where it's like, you have to remember when you know, Jordan was at his height and everything, it's like, there was no Twitter or anything, so it's like, all you knew of him is what you saw in the games, or right, like, right. You know, a brief interview with you know, with the sports media after. Like, that's kind of it. You know,
and he was so curated at, like, uh-huh. His own image. Like, he was able to curate it in such a way that, you know, he put that out there that he was this, you know, happy-go-lucky, you know, awesome basketball player. Turns out maybe he was kind of an asshole, but
yeah, they go into that. Probably one of the most emotional parts in the show. Like, he gets more choked up talking about this than talking about his dad who was murdered. There's like a part where everyone's kind of talking about how Jordan is he was like a bully in practice. He would just like keep poking at people. And, you know, there's a part where he's talking about it. And he's like, one, I'm doing that to make you a better player. And he's like, and if you don't want to play, like, if you don't want to give everything to this game, then I don't need you. Like, and as he's saying that, he starts like crying and he gets choked up and he ends the interview. I was like, damn, dude. But, so the Last Dance was like, it was a 10 part. So like 10 hour series on ESPN that aired over, you know, Sunday nights. And they would do like 2 episodes each week. And it was about the Bulls dynasty of the 90s and specifically about Jordan. And I thought it was great. Like, it was, you know, you kind of know where it's going because, you know, they won 6 championships and all that. But, you know, they managed to find enough drama within there. Lots of cool, like, footage from the time, like behind the scenes footage that had never aired from the time. And just like, just really well done ESPN documentary. Like, a lot of their documentaries are really well done, but they really, like, you know, put it together for this, like, awesome, like, 90s soundtrack to it and stuff that, like, really kind of brings you back in time. I think it's well worth watching, but then again, it's like, it is always coming from my perspective of, like, the Bulls were the greatest thing ever back then, so.
Oh, sure. I wonder how, like, I heard that, you know, with the success of this, that ESPN is going to do something similar with Tom Brady, and I wonder how that's going to play.
I forgot who put out a tweet, like, after it aired, like, who should they do, like, a 10-part documentary on next? And, like, for me, I think, yeah, maybe Tom Brady. I think Tiger Woods would be
a good one, yeah.
Like, he's undeniably the greatest golfer of all time, and he's got interesting drama outside of the sport.
Like I look at, like, oh, who's the most famous, you know, hockey player or someone? It's like Wayne Gretzky, but, like, I mean, I don't think he doesn't have, like, that outside of the sport kind of notoriety or anything. So,
like, I don't know. I think he might have had some impact on the culture. I don't know, but
definitely with the trade to LA, and he advanced the sport for sure.
Yeah. One of my my serious response is Tiger Woods, but my response that I said on Twitter was Tony Hawk. But honestly,
Tony Hawk would be good.
Tony Hawk had a huge impact on, like, video game culture, if anything. Like, it's,
and skate culture as well. Like, I mean, skate, like, he kind of single-handedly
pushed that sport out. Yeah,
yeah, like, and the X Games. Like, I don't think without Tony Hawk, we don't have the X Games. Like, they've diminished considerably over the last 20 years, but I remember, like, you know, oh my God, Tony Hawk's going to be, like, they're going to do half pipe at the X Games. Like, what the fuck is the X Games?
It's
like,
right,
sport Olympics. Like, and, like, the reason you watched it was because of Tony Hawk and, like, and his relationship to video games and stuff. So, yeah, like,
hey, I'd watch it.
Yeah.
Sticking with TV, I've been watching, and this is going to come as no surprise to you, The Last Drive-In Season 2 on Shudder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think his picks this season are, like, more pointed. Like, he's trying to say something with the stuff that he picks. Really interesting. Every week, there's at least one movie every week where I'm like, oh, that's an interesting choice.
Still not the choices you want, though, right?
They're coming. Mandy is coming this season. I know that for a fact. So okay. I have a feeling it's going to be the season finale because it's one of the most requested. But, you know, the other week he did Troma's War, so a trauma film, followed by One Cut of the Dead. And he did that to, like, you know, and he did this really great, like, 5-minute speech at the end of both films where he's just like, you know, the movies I showed you tonight is to show you that anybody can make a film. And I was like, that's really, like, he did it obviously way better than I just did. But, you know, like, he's trying to say something with his picks every week. Just really interesting stuff. He's done even some non-horror this season. Like, he did Heathers one week. This last week, he did some movie called Deadbeat at Dawn, which is like this biker fucking low-budget movie. Yeah, it's been really interesting and really fun. But there's been some drama outside of the show, but on the show itself, it's been great.
Yeah, I caught some of the outside the show drama.
Which is weird. Like, I mean, I have no problem talking about it, but it's like, it's kind of a weird thing where someone accused Joe Bob of being homophobic, and it was based on something he said in an article that was written last summer. It's just like, okay, and I see where you're coming from, and I'm not going to yell at people that are criticizing him. I don't agree, but I think that the way some of his fans reacted to the person that wrote the article kind of freaked me out. Like, it made me feel like, you know, I'm part of this fandom, like this family of people that watch this every week, and it's like, dude, we're not a cult. Like, fucking chill out. Like, if someone wants to say something bad about him, well, it's not my job to defend him.
Right.
Like, yeah.
He can defend himself, and you can still like him and his show. Like, it's fine.
And I do think, you know, for as much as it creeped me out the way some of his fans responded to that article, I think the way he responded speaks for itself, like, and made me not ashamed to be a fan of the show, because he's just like, hey, you know, first off, he told everyone to fucking leave the guy alone that wrote it, and he's been like, look, I want to listen to everybody, and I want everyone to feel like they're part of our family. I don't want to make any group feel like I'm, you know, picking on them, so.
Right, you know, it's, he's shown that he, you know, whether he was misperceived in his comments or not, like, that he wants everybody to be a part of horror and enjoy horror with him. So,
yeah, it's, I knew ever since he came back that this was gonna be an issue that cropped up, because he has like this Texas cowboy persona, and so like half the shit he says sounds very right wing, you know. But you know, if you're someone who watches week in and out like me, dude rips on Republicans all the time. The thing is, he rips on Democrats and Republicans, and it's like, I'm not saying it's both sides or whatever. It's like, the dude, he picks on both political groups. That's just what he does. And so, like, if you want to believe that he's a right-wing Republican, you could easily see that in him. And if you want to believe he's, like, a secret Democrat, you could see that in him. I just kind of take him at face value that he's going to rip on both people, and I'm okay with it, you know? But yeah, anyways, back to the substance of it, I do think that this season has been even more interesting than season one.
Good.
Just a couple more things here, Chris. One more TV show, Devs. Have you watched that?
I have not seen Devs.
Pretty good sci-fi show from Alex Garland, who did Ex Machina.
Okay.
I think he was the writer of 28 Days Later back in the day and shit. But, you know, he did Ex Machina, he did Annihilation, and now this is him bringing his sci-fi shit to TV. Really good and really interesting and really smart sci-fi that I was super into for, I think it was just 8 episodes, and I think it's just like a limited series. I don't think they're doing a season 2. I will say, though, like, the last 5 minutes had me kind of scratching my head, like, what? It kind of sucked that, you know, I was so super into it the whole way, and then the ending, I was just kind of like, huh, all right, well, what else is on?
That's a shame. Like, you know, you go through 8 episodes of something, and then, like, the last 5 minutes can maybe not spoil it.
But it didn't ruin it. It didn't make me regret anything, but I was just like, huh, I thought the ending was going to be better. Or, I don't know, it felt like the sci-fi stuff at the end was unrelated to everything that came before. I don't know.
Okay.
Be prepared for that if you ever go check it out. I'd still say it's worth checking out. And seen a couple movies too. Won't be long on any of these, but Bad Education, new HBO film with Hugh Jackman. Really good. I think probably the best movie I've seen this year, that's from this year. Hugh Jackman plays the superintendent at the school, and someone on the high school newspaper staff starts looking into school funds and uncovers a bunch of corruption in the school, and this is based on a true story. Just a really great film. I don't want to say too much because I think this is a really good movie to just kind of go in like knowing just that. And so I'll just say that, except, you know, if you're a fan of the film Election, I think you're going to really dig this movie too. I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. Seems interesting.
I watched The Lovebirds on Netflix, which is,
I did too.
What do you think? Was that your other thing?
I have one other thing I can talk about too. But yeah, I liked it enough.
Yeah, like I saw a lot of people. I saw some people like really shitting on it. I saw one person say they couldn't watch it; it was so bad they turned it off. And I'm like,
I mean, it's a pretty standard romantic comedy.
Yeah.
It reminded me a lot of, I said this on somebody's review today, of a movie called Date Night, which is Steve Carell and Tina Fey. It was from 2010. But it's like that formula, right? Like, go out on a date, bad shit happens. Relationship maybe was getting stale. This helps spice it up, and they go on a weird adventure. It's fun. Like, I think that Nanjiani and Ray have great chemistry. Like, they carry this movie.
I'm with you 100% on this. It's not like some amazing thing, but I dig this type of movie. It reminded me of Date Night, Game Night, anything like that, where it's like a series of wacky comic adventures, like in this romantic comedy, but there's a little bit of action and thrown in. I just dig that formula, and I really like those two, like the two leads in this. I think I have a little bit of a crush on Issa Rae, so like that helps, and I think. Kumail is funny as hell.
He's great. And I didn't know much about Issa Rae before this, but I kind of want to go check out her HBO show that she has. What, Insecure?
I don't watch that show, but I've caught sometimes you watch the big show on Sunday night on HBO, and then this will come on after, and so I've caught parts of it, and it's funny. It's also very graphic in terms of sex on the show.
Yeah. Okay.
Not
opposed to that.
Yeah. Like I said, I think I have a little bit of a thing for her, and she's great in this. And yeah, I mean, it's total cookie cutter. This is what we're doing. That they're going to come back together by the end because of all the shit they go through. But
yeah,
it's fine. It's totally fine.
Two things I kind of wanted to note about it, though. I'm glad that. Trailers have a horrible tendency to especially with comedies, to show the funniest jokes in there are some good ones in the trailer, but there's so much more in the movie that I think lands much better. And also I am 100% surprised that this was going to be I think it was supposed to come out this past weekend on Memorial Day weekend. That this was going to be a Memorial Day weekend release and not a Valentine's Day release. It seems crazy to me.
Yeah, should have been perfect for that.
I mean, I suppose counter programming, if you're going, there were going to be summer blockbusters or whatever coming out this weekend, but that seems such a wasted opportunity to not release it when couples are maybe going out.
I think that they thought this was going to be the next, the big sick. It's the same team, and that movie made hundreds of millions of dollars worldwide as it played all summer. I don't know. Maybe that's
what I don't know. That was also more of a dramedy and
that was more special than this is. And this is just them doing a total genre movie. And
I enjoyed it. It was fun. Yeah. It's just like it was not going to ever be that. But yeah, it was good. It's on Netflix, so you can definitely give it a shot.
I got one final movie for me, and that is a little film called Driveways, and that is the final film from the late, great Brian Dennehy. And it's just a really small, pretty familiar story about like this old guy who's a neighbor who like befriends this young kid next door. You know, think Gran Torino, but minus the violence and racism. It's just a very simple, like, little kid and old man becoming friends. Worth checking out, in my opinion, because it is Dennehy's last role, and he is great in it. There's a speech he gives about how he wishes he could go back in time and be young again, and if you could keep it together during that speech, you're a stronger man than me. It was really good. Really good final performance from him.
Nice.
I guess I'll leave it at that now that we've spent a good 45 minutes talking about my shit. We covered some of yours, so what else did
you do? We covered the two primary ones, and as we were sitting here talking, I just started watching season 2 of Dark Side of the Ring, which is a docuseries by Vice about wrestling. Professional wrestling. The first season I thought was great. Like, a lot of it was stuff I grew up with, Macho Man Randy Savage, Miss Elizabeth, stuff like that. This one starts off with the first episode starts off with Chris Benoit and Eddie Guerrero, which if you watched wrestling in the late 90s, early 2000s, they were pretty big stars at that time. Eddie Guerrero, they found him dead in his hotel room. I did not realize that he was best friends with Chris Benoit, who famously went on to commit double murder of his wife and son and then kill himself.
Yeah.
So like, this is like some dark shit. and they do a great job of it. And it's, I don't know where they're going. It's a two-part episode, so part one was the first episode of the season. The whole season's done at this point, but I don't know where they're going to go. Like, they end up with, you know, the revelation that Chris Benoit had killed his wife and son, and they have a whole nother episode
dedicated
to Chris Benoit. So it's like,
yeah.
It's very interesting. They don't shy away from anything. Like, it's dark.
Yeah. So I'm not I'm not into wrestling at all, but I randomly did watch the Chris Benoit episode of this, and really well done. Very dark and tragic story. And just some like interesting stuff, like in the media aftermath, no one had any idea like what really had happened. And like, the WWE was putting on this big thing, like celebrating Chris Benoit.
Yeah, like the next night. So, like, they found out on Sunday night, and the next night they had like a tribute show.
Like, and I forgot who it was. Like, Cena was like, "I'm not comfortable like celebrating this guy, not knowing what happened." And I think it was him, and he ended up being right. Like, he kind of looked bad in retrospect. That everyone's like, "Oh, you know, like they're doing this huge tribute to the guy," and the dude fucking murdered his whole family, and then of course they get into why that might be.
I haven't seen that second episode yet, but knowing this whole story, like, I do remember people like at the time were, it's like, this is awful, like Chris Benoit, like, erase him from history, and like, you can't, like,
yeah.
And also, there are extenuating circumstances. Like, it does not forgive. I think his tag team partner here, longtime tag team partner Dean Malenko, in the first episode, like, says, like, it's unforgivable. Like, it is.
Yeah.
You can't forgive it. But I also think that it's very important to talk about it and to show that, like, these guys are, they're more than just the performers that are on there. They have issues. They go through things. They're normal people. And I think they do a great job with this series. I'm interested to see how it turns out. Obviously I know the story, how it turns out, but it's interesting because at the time people were like, we're never talking about that. Like, he's been erased from memory. It's like he never existed in a lot of respects. And now for them to come out and kind of talk about it, I have Chris Jericho, who had a lot of interaction with him over the years, and to have him speaking candidly, to have Eddie Guerrero's wife there, Chris Benoit's sister-in-law talking as well. Like, it's crazy, the amount of people they get for this.
I don't know if they talked to him in the episode that you watched, but they talked to his surviving kid.
Heartbreaking, dude. It starts off this person looks very familiar, because he looks
like his dad.
He looks like his dad, and it's his older son, and it's heartbreaking, because he's talking about how his dad was his hero.
And he still loves his dad despite what his dad did. And you have to keep in mind, there's no excusing what his dad did, but that wasn't him. That's not the guy his son knew,
Right. That's where that fuzzy, we're just going to erase him from memory.
No, you have to learn from
what right. Like, it's, you don't have to celebrate him necessarily. But you can't erase what he did for the profession. And it's also important to understand how he might have got to the point where he would do something like that.
Yeah.
Give it a go if you haven't out there.
Yeah, I'll back you. Like I said, I only watched the one episode that I watched, but it's very good. And it's available on YouTube, so anyone can watch this.
Neat.
I don't know, where were you watching it on?
Watching on Hulu. I guess it airs on the Vice channel. I didn't know Vice had their own channel.
But yeah, they do. It's fucking random shit, but yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, they do an excellent job here. I'm not sure about the rest of the content on Vice. I've seen some of their, when they used to have that HBO show, I don't know if they still do.
I don't know. I thought it was all right, like the Vice News or whatever.
Yeah, the reporting is decent. But I don't know how a whole TV station of their random shit would be.
Oh, a lot of it is pot smoking shows and just cheap ass reality type shit.
Yeah. Oh. And that's about it for me.
I brought more than enough for both of us on what we've been watching.
Yeah, it's a weird time. We're in our 2.5 months now of quarantine, which brings us to our two films, which also relate to quarantine.
You outdid yourself with these picks.
Yeah, I chose The Crazies from 1973 and the remake from 2010. We're going to do them similar to how we did last episode, where we go, we're going to do the first movie first, and then we'll kind of take a look at that remake. I think it's the easiest way to do that this year, if we're going to compare them to each other. You want to jump into it?
We never thought it would happen. Nobody gets in or out of that town now. Is that clear?
The girl just died.
How do you intend to let the people know about all this?
We were asleep. They dragged us right out of the house.
Are we under martial law?
Don't talk to me or anybody else unless you got a voice print check.
All hell's broke loose in town. Nobody knows what's going on.
Now look, you just can't push us around this way.
We've got to get a nuclear weapon in the air above that town.
I ain't taking me no place.
They started something they can't stop. The crazy.
To start it off, the Crazies from 1973.
Directed by George Romero.
Go ahead. Wasn't it written and directed by him, or no?
Written by Romero as well, along with Paul McCullough, who I guess he wrote the original script for it, and Romero kind of modified it. Originally, well, maybe not originally, but it has a alternate title as well called Codename Trixie. Funny enough, okay. I rented The Crazies 1973 because I do not own that one. To rewatch it, and it says The Crazies. It has the poster for The Crazies, and the movie starts, and it says Codename Trixie, and I'm like,
really?
Did I get fucked up? Like, what happened here? And then I looked into it, and it's an alternate title for the film. And actually, they mentioned Trixie a few times in the film.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It is the bioweapon that causes all of this. But yeah, released in 1973, budget of about $275,000.
Which is super small.
It is super small, but for Romero, that's actually probably a fairly big budget.
I mean, it was a step up from what he was doing just, 5 years earlier, which, yeah. You know, what was that, 50 grand or something you spent on Night of the Living Dead? Super low budget.
Yeah, like, I mean, it's a huge, huge improvement budget-wise.
Doesn't look like it did very well in terms of box office.
Box office was about half of that.
I don't know how. Did it not, Aaron, like, was it not in theaters? Like, what the hell? $143,000 box office, it looks like.
Yeah, not a ton of money coming out of that one.
And interestingly, like, this is one of the Romero films that I feel like doesn't get talked about a lot. Like, and I've never seen it till we watched it for this episode. So
okay, so this was a new watch for you. Yeah. All right, interesting. And you had seen the remake.
Yeah, so like this was definitely like different than what I expected, honestly. Like this is an interesting movie in my opinion. Should probably give the setup of like what the story, like what is this about, you know?
So The Crazies is about a quarantine in a small Pennsylvania town where the military comes in, and they kind of lock down this town because a bio agent has escaped into the water, and from a downed military plane that crashed like a week ago. They bring all these military people in. They start kind of rounding people up and get testing them, I guess. Well, supposedly testing them. and things go bad. So the bio agent, though, basically kind of makes you go a little crazy. Hence the name. And you get a little violent towards other people. And that ends up with violence throughout the town and everything kind of going haywire.
Yeah, this was a really interesting film for me. Because again, I don't want to keep referring to the remake because we're going to talk about that in a minute anyways, but just coming in from the perspective of all I know is the remake, which the remake kind of plays more like a zombie film.
Yep.
This is way different. This is kind of about like the breakdown of trust between people and the government.
Yeah, very, very much like that. When we get to the remake,
they put that stuff in there a little bit.
A little bit, but it's very prominent here. Like, there's actually points in this movie where you have government bureaucrats sitting around, you know, making decisions based on this. They're just in a room kind of talking. They're not out in the town. They're not on the ground. They're just making decisions and trying to get, you know, in touch with the president and, you know, oh, it's too early to do such a thing. And you have one guy who's very much like, we need to do this. And they're like, oh, no, it's too early for that. We don't want
scientists.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's crazy. Like, that they're just not listening to him because the political fallout of it, and it's kind of nightmarish because that's because, the situation we're going through right now.
Yeah, like watching these films from now we're sitting in the middle of this pandemic, like actually happening. It's crazy. Like I think I said to you earlier on Twitter, I'm like, these films hit a little different now. I think the most interesting shit in this original version of the Crazies is the stuff that happens in like this military command post where they're planning and trying to figure out how to contain this outbreak to this one town. And, fortunately for this film, that's a big part of this film. That's like, not only is it the most interesting thing, I think it takes up the most screen time. To the point where one of my notes was, who is the protagonist of this film? Because you spend so much time with just these military guys who, they're not evil. They're just trying to do a job. They're trying to save people in a way.
The antagonist here is the virus, or it's the virus, and it is the bureaucracy that is happening outside of the town that is preventing them from getting the supplies they need, getting the lab equipment they need, getting the people they need to keep this lockdown going. There are characters, they introduce us very early on to boyfriend and girlfriend who are expecting a child.
And they end up being like who the protagonist would be. But I'm just saying they get way less screen time than, for instance, in the remake, the same type of character.
Because they're kind of like, they're the adventure part of this. But I think, as you said, the interesting part of this is that the handling of it from the government and military perspective. The adventure part's fine. Like where they're on the run and dealing with, are our companions here, are they infected? It's an interesting, balance that they have, but the big pull is that military angle.
Yeah, like just some of the lines, like I think there's a part where the scientist guy is like, oh, gentlemen, what we're dealing with here, this is no flu virus. Or I'm just like, holy fuck, dude, Romero called this shit from fucking 50 years ago. Like, how the hell did he do that? I think the other interesting aspect of this, and it plays out throughout the film and it plays into the ending, is, well, for one, like I said, like, this doesn't feel like a zombie movie at all. And in fact, like, other than the very beginning where you see what the disease does to like one guy where he like goes ape shit and fucking kills his family, right? You don't really see any more crazies after that, or you don't know. Like, you don't know if they're crazies or not.
Right.
Because the way people react to being quarantined, the government can't tell the difference between who's the crazies or not, because the people who aren't infected are going crazy too.
Yeah.
Like, that's the most interesting thing about this whole movie to me. And that plays into the ending because the townspeople end up killing one of our main characters. You know, like that's what happens at the end. So, and it's just because they've gone crazy. Like, you don't know whether they're infected or not. Like, it's just people are mad because they're being quarantined. I'm like, man, this is all hitting super close to fucking home now. You know?
Yeah, because you could just imagine that if, Illinois or Pennsylvania had deployed the National Guard to quarantine if how people would react. Like, they're storming the fucking state capital of Michigan
because they can't get a haircut and they have to wear a mask. Like, it's
right. And that's without on the boots on the ground presence of the military. Yeah. That's just, advisory, stay home. We're not allowing businesses to open. We will shut them down, via the police if we have to. And this was like, and this is all very quick. It's all very sudden. It all happens over the course of 24, 48 hours. So it's a little unbelievable in that regard, but you see it now where it's like, we're 10 weeks in and, people are going batshit crazy because they can't go get their hair cut. They can't go to the bar. It's nuts.
Yeah, and so I don't know. I was genuinely surprised by like the serious, heavy tone of this film and the themes that it's dealing with. Just because, while when when we're gonna get to the remake, but like there's seeds of this in the remake, but it's like that's not really what like the remake is trying to be. The remake is kind of like just like this thrill ride. Like, this is like a really thoughtful kind of movie, I thought. And
yeah, it's really, and to be fair to Romero, we look at his films and it's like, oh, he made zombie movies. Haha, isn't that funny? Like, but you look at Night of the Living Dead, you look at Dawn of the Dead, like they are films that had messages and very overt messages, but also dealing with some subtlety. Like, you can enjoy Dawn of the Dead as a zombie movie because it is, but there's also, the message against capitalism and consumerism, yeah. And Night of the Living Dead dealing with racism. And
what's interesting is like Romero always claimed like Night of the Living Dead, he wasn't trying to make a political statement with it. And I'm just like, get out of here. You know what gives it away is his later fucking zombie films were super like in your face with the message they were doing every time. Like, yeah. Land of the Dead, Diary of the Dead, all that shit. He was always like, I like Land of the Dead, but like, you couldn't possibly miss that he was making a statement about, capitalism and about the Bush era and stuff like that. Like, it was just, that was what the movie was about. Like, there was no missing it. So, like, I don't know what he was talking about when he always claimed that, well, we just,
stumbled across that.
The reason that the main character is black and Night of the Living Dead is just because that was the actor he got. I'm like, come on, dude. Just admit it. You're trying to make a statement. But even if not, whatever. Like, whether he meant to make a statement or not, all of his films have politics,
Yeah, and there's, there's messaging there. And I just love how he does cast some blame, like, at politicians in this. Like, that they would definitely be the holdup to,
this is a lot of red tape and stuff like that. Yeah.
But he doesn't really cast blame on any of the people on the ground. I will say I did find it a little absurd, though. Towards the end of the film, there is a doctor who has been grabbed. He is part of the Trixie Project, and he's just kind of like, we need to get one of you guys that were on the project into town, like, for what reason, not really sure, but they bring this guy into town and he sets up like a lab in the high school where they're also bringing all the people, and it's just fucking absurd. Like, he comes running out, I found it. And like the military just like, oh no, get the fuck over. Like, you don't think that the military would know like this guy?
There's a scientist in the fucking home, like, home ec room or whatever the fuck.
Right. Like, he just runs out, like, oh, it's like, it's just some fat dude. Just throw him in with the rest of the crazies.
Like, well, shit, it was like breaking down completely by that point. Wasn't there like all the people in the school were going crazy and shit? Like, I don't know. I think that whole breakdown, it's like this kind of pact of civility between people and the government, really,
it's very hard of it. Yes.
And it's very like eerie and like resonates a lot with what's happening today. So I found this movie to be not only like, I think it's an entertaining film, and honestly could be one of like near the top of my Romero movies now that I've seen it. But it's also, yeah, it's got some real, like, interesting stuff on its mind, and it, like, does not feel like a zombie movie at all to me. It's really about, like, I think it has more in common with films like Contagion and Outbreak than it does, like, Night of the Living Dead. Like,
yeah, it's more about the quarantine and the handling of it than anything else, and I think that really, that helps set it apart here.
For sure.
Like, it's not another zombie movie. And granted, he didn't make another zombie movie for 5 years after that, right? He doesn't make Dawn of the Dead until 1978. But like, he certainly was trying something different here. And I think it's an interesting film. And the acting, not great. Romero's not a great cinematographer.
His directing is also a little bit like point and shoot. But I will say this. Yeah. This movie is edited like fucking almost like a modern film. Like, it super quick cuts all the way. Like, it just kept cutting the stuff. Especially as it started to pick up its pacing. Like, it really, it was edited like crazy.
It's very well cut. And maybe this is just the film quality from 1973, and everything seemed a little washed out in the version I was watching. So color wise, it wasn't great, but it, for a movie from what, 47 years ago,
with a pretty small budget, considering that time,
to be poignant and relevant today is pretty impressive.
The other thing I forgot to mention when you said you rented it, I found it on Amazon Prime for free, and not only did I find it for free, I found two files or versions of the same fucking movie on there. It's like Amazon can't even keep track of what they own. They own, as far as I can tell, it's identical versions of The Crazies, but they have two different cover arts, and you can watch either one. I think it's the same running time and everything, but and they're still there. So,
immediately after I had rented The Crazies, I found out it was also available on some streaming service called Quibi. I don't know anything about Quibi, but I was like, oh, there goes $3 that I'm never getting back, I guess.
Oh well. It's a good movie. So, I guess, are we going to do ratings?
Ratings, yeah. Right. Where do you fall on The Crazies, Jeff, from 1973?
Like I said, not only do I think this was entertaining, I think this gave you a lot to chew on intellectually. Could be on the top half of my Romero films at this point. Again, this is my first time, so, maybe over the years that changes, whatever, but I'm going to give it a 7.5 out of 10.
All right. I am going to slightly lower.
Okay.
Mostly because you know my aversion to fractions. But I am going to go a 7 out of 10. I do think that it is, it's an entertaining movie. Does give you a lot to chew on.
It's not perfect, and like you said, it doesn't like look amazing always. And I don't mean to cut you off. Sorry.
No, but it is. It doesn't look perfect, but there's enough there. There's enough meat to chew on, and it's distinctly different from the next film we're going to talk about.
Would you mind taking a look at Bill?
Sure. What's wrong?
I don't know. He's just not right.
She worries too much.
I'm fine.
You got any plans this weekend?
She worries too much. I'm fine.
Ben.
What's Dad doing? He has a knife.
How long has it been playing statue?
A couple hours now. Same look Rory gave me.
All things wise and wonderful.
We're in trouble.
All right, so that brings us to The Crazies 2010, directed by Brecht Eisner, who you may know of from a film called Sahara back in 2005, starring
McConaughey,
or more recently the Vin Diesel film The Last Witch Hunter, which I have not seen.
Weird filmography, and very limited. Like, that was his last movie, The Last Witch Hunter. That was 2015, so it's 5 years ago.
He's been doing
5 years between The Crazies and Last Witch Hunter.
He does some TV here and there. He's been pretty, he's been getting some work on a show called The Expanse, which I've seen the first couple seasons of, and that's pretty good. But yeah, like he does not do a ton of work. It's like he gets a film, does it, and then kind of sits around a little bit. It's a weird thing to do. Like normally you look at like, you know, people that don't do a lot of films, like sometimes you'll see, oh, they did these music videos or they did these like commercials or something in between.
You know, like, fucking 40 episodes of Mad Men or something. You know what I mean? Like, right.
Like this dude's got nothing.
It's weird because this is like very competently made at the very least, I will say. Like,
yeah. And I mean, I thought Sahara was competently made adventure film as well. So. So The Crazies, 2010, Brett Eisner. Let's see what information we got here on it. Unfortunately, I just clicked away for a second.
$20 million budget.
Yeah, so decent budget. Did okay, I think.
Looks like $55 million box office. At least that's what I'm seeing on Wiki.
Yeah.
That's not like hitting it out of the park on a $20 million budget, but I'm sure they made it up on DVDs.
Yeah. And, $20 million budget, you know, you probably spend another. They made money on this film. Yeah. It stars a named actor.
Yeah.
Timothy Olyphant is, he's maybe not the biggest actor, but he's had some roles.
Yeah.
The fact that he's in this, a big jump up over the production quality of Romero's.
Yeah.
At The Crazies. Different take here, though. Still same premise, plane crash, military plane crash, which releases a bio agent into the groundwater, and people start getting infected. It does not start off. That's something we kind of missed, I guess. Like the Crazies, Romero's version starts off with a brutal murder.
Yeah.
You don't get that right away here.
Well, the opening shot is like the house on fire. So it's like calling back to the opening of the original.
Yes.
But then that's like after shit has kind of like gone a little bit crazy, and then we go back in time a couple days.
Right. Yeah. Then you rewind, whereas Romero's kind of jumps you right into it. Like, yeah. You know, the quarantine is happening now. This happens maybe right before that. Like the plane has crashed. People start getting infected, and you see these two cops are out watching a baseball game, a kid's baseball game, and dude just wanders out into the middle of the field. With a shotgun.
Yeah.
And the cop shoots him dead.
I think it's a good start. It's like a nice like hook where it's just like right away. So, like, it's not like starting off with the guy burning down his office and shit, but it's like, okay, something really cool happens in the first 10 minutes where you're like, oh, okay, something's not right here, you know?
Yep. Then, though, this film kind of like, it does not ramp up right away, right? Like
it gives you some time to feel the impact of that, like what that does to that town. I think it's well done, honestly. Like,
yeah, because he makes that, he shoots the guy, and then you kind of go through
where the
family meets up with him.
Yeah, and he's like trying to get the toxicology report, and then he's talking to the family saying the guy was drunk, and they're like, no, he hasn't had a drop of booze in what, 3 years or something, they say, right? Like, you have some characters, you kind of care what's happening, and, you know, it's not just like, this is a fun thrill ride of a movie, but it's like, there's a little bit of a ramp up at the start here, and you get to know these people a little bit, I feel like.
Much more than Romero's version, right? Like, these are actual characters. You meet up with David, Timothy Olyphant's character. He's one of the cops, and you meet up with Judy, who is his wife, girlfriend. I'm not really sure how that's established, but she's a doctor instead of a nurse in this one. She's kind of like the small town doctor. And that lays in an interesting thing too, whereas she actually, you know, looks over a patient that ends up doing a heinous murder and burning the house down that we talked about at the beginning. And that's when kind of things really kick off at that point.
Yeah. Also, change of setting here. I don't know why, but we're in small town Iowa as opposed to it's the town of Ogden Marsh.
Yeah, it's because what they're walking to Kansas City at the end, right, or something like that.
Yeah, and it's I don't know why they changed it from Pennsylvania to here, but I do think maybe. I mean, this was shot in Georgia, I think, mostly. But maybe Georgia looks like small town Iowa. All I can tell you is, like, the small town Iowa feel, they got, like, 100% right. It feels like any small town that would be around here. It looks like parts of my town where I live.
And out where you are, it's more flatland, right? Like, you don't have mountains. That is a thing with Pennsylvania. Western Pennsylvania or Eastern Pennsylvania, we kind of are bisected by the Appalachian Mountains. So, if that gave you the more, you know, Midwestern look, I guess, you know, shooting in Georgia. Although, I mean, they do give you that wide open, those wide open shots, but a lot of this is shot at night. So,
Yeah. But it does, you know, especially in the early parts, it just feels very accurate to what a small town around here would look like. And
so we don't get the instant military presence and characters.
You don't know what the military's thinking in this. That's where I was going to go to next. Like, all you really get is these satellite views that'll be like initiate containment protocol or like you see what the military is doing, but like you're not getting, like, you know, in the original film, you're spending a lot of time with the military characters figuring out what's like how they're going to contain it. And here they kind of just show up as like the evil government, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And that's how they're played. They're
kind
of played for the villain in this one, which is fine. But it doesn't have that, like, hey, we're all in this shit together. Like, hey, maybe we created this and that's a problem. But, like, you know, everybody on the ground is in the same boat. We're trying to protect ourselves and we're trying to protect everyone else and shit's going bad. Here it's, you know, the men in black show up and they gather everybody up by force and bring them all to the football stadium.
There is an interesting, like, this remake, while it is, like, in my opinion, much more straightforward, like, thrill ride, kind of almost zombie movie, there are things, like, there is a moment, early on when Timothy Oliphant, like, goes to, I think, the mayor, and he's, like, talking about how they need to turn off the drinking water, because he believes that there is a sickness that's spreading, and it's being spread through the water. And it's kind of like this little, they have like this little mini economy versus public health debate, which is kind of going on right now, where it's, you know, he wants to turn off the water. And I think it's the mayor's like, no, dude, like the farmers need that for their crops. Like, we're going to be devastated economically if we shut off the water. He's like, he tells them the water stays on. Just a little thing early on that, like, this thing isn't completely devoid of ideas. Like,
they're not as fleshed out, but they are there. They are certainly there.
And Timothy Oliphant, like, he has like a sidekick character, like it's a deputy or whatever, who kind of functions like the firefighter's friend in the original.
Yeah,
because he becomes the one that, like, becomes more violent and you're like, is he infected or not? But I do think that the, like, banter between Oliphant and him in this is, like, really funny.
That character, Russell, played by Joe Anderson, they have good chemistry, the two of them. Like, they seem like they're actual buddies.
Yeah, I like the kind of the way like they'll joke to each other and shit is, I don't know, just fun. Like it's like a fun little light touch on top of all the craziness happening. And you know, you already kind of noted this. Like Oliphant at this point is like a movie star, or at least at the very least, you know, small screen big star. But he was in Tarantino's last film. I think he adds a lot to this. I think he's like a great actor, and you know, I don't think you would get him for this movie if it was made now. Like, I think he would be.
Oh, no way.
This would be below his like pay grade at this point. But it's great to have him here. I think he's such a great presence, and just one example of the banter between him and his like sidekick buddy. Like, there's a part like later on in the movie where they're through like a car wash, which is one of the great moments in the film. And his buddy sticks his like shotgun out the window or something, and then it gets like snatched because they're going through the car wash and it just like gets ripped away from him. And his buddy goes, "I saw movement," and Alfred goes, "Everything's fucking moving." I don't know. There's a lot of parts like that where it's just like got a little laugh out of me. Anyways, not to completely derail this or whatever, but I'm just like looking over my notes, you know.
I mean, that's a. There are fun scenes like that.
I think this movie has a lot of big, cool set pieces.
Yeah, there's one. The poster kind of points at this one.
Yes.
Yeah, the pitchfork.
Hospital scene.
Yeah, so like they, you know, they're taking all the residents of this town, and they're basically testing them at a, you know, as they enter this camp. And if you are, you know, if your temperature is over a certain point, they're moving you into a secondary tented area, also locking you down because
like strapping people to, you know, gurneys or whatever.
Yeah. And basically like shit goes bad and you know, everything breaks down, much as one would expect. And a crazy guy with, you know, he has a pitchfork. After the military has left, they've left all these patients strapped to their gurneys. He is just systematically going through and stabbing people with the pitchfork, dragging it along. Like, it's a scary scene because the man shows no emotion. Like, there's no.
Yeah.
No exertion. There's not. It's just like he rips it up, stabs them, and moves on. And you know, the Judy, I believe that's her name, right? She kind of grabs his attention. She's trying to stop this, and then like that, it all just ratchets up. It's a very fun scene. You know, obviously she gets saved right at the last moment by David, but it's fun. Like, and there are a bunch of those in there. There's also some ridiculousness, which we'll get to.
there's a
bunch of good set pieces.
There's another really good, great gag with a bone saw where it's like it's plugged in and it's on. Oh, and it's like crawling across the floor, like coming right at dude. I think it comes right at his crotch or something.
Yep.
Just like. The movie comes up with a bunch of scenarios like that, and really like has a lot of fun with those scenarios and milks them for all they're worth. You know, you have the pitchfork scene, the bone saw scene. There is a scene in the bedroom of the house where the one family who's been all infected is inside the house waiting for them in the room with the crib in it. Yeah. Remember that?
And this to note, this is also this is the house of the. Guy that is shot in the opening scene.
And then, like, I think in that scene, like, he stabs a knife through the lady's hand, and then he, like, you know, pushes it toward, like, her throat, so basically she, like, stabs herself in the throat with the knife that's going through her hand. Like, you know, we already mentioned the car wash scene. There's a big scene near the end that's in, like an auto body shop. Like, I don't know, like, I think this is, like, I think each movie has a strength, and I think the strength of this movie is the cool set pieces.
Yeah, it's the acting.
Timothy Oliphant, and it looks good. Like, You know, it doesn't look like a cheap movie. Like,
well, it doesn't for 97% of it.
There's parts of it that make it look like it came out in 2010. Like, it feels like a movie of that era for whatever reason.
There is, specifically, I'm talking about, like, the end. So they...
like the CGI or whatever.
Yeah, we do spoil these movies. They nuke the town.
Yeah.
David and Judy are escaping in this big rig, driving as fast as they can, and the... Yeah, when the aftershock or the blowback from the nuclear blast hits them and throws the truck, it looks fucking absurd. it looks worse than what I remember 2010 looking like.
I think in 2010 I didn't think much of it. Like I thought it looked fine, but yeah, it looks
like it looks like some Twister shit.
Yeah.
But the rest of the film looks very good. Like, it's very well shot. The darks are, it's nice and dark, but just enough light to see movement and keep you creeped out. And another set piece is that's great is there's these hillbillies that kind of show up.
I was just gonna touch on that. Yeah. Another eerie correlation to today. Like, right when I watched this is right when that story broke about those guys down in Georgia who kind of cornered a black man while he was jogging and killed him. No reason to do this. They claimed that they thought he was like a robbery suspect. He looked like a robbery suspect. And then there's a scene here where like these kind of hillbillies are driving around in a pickup truck, killing people just for fun. Like,
yeah,
using the this outbreak as an excuse to go out and kill people. Like, again, it's one of those scenes where, back when it came out, I probably thought nothing of it. But, you know, you watch movies in the context of your life that you're living right now, and it's just like, whoa, dude. Like, you know, there's little things in here. Again, it's mostly just about a bunch of cool set pieces. But there's a little thing. There's one moment where they, like, they corner one of the government guys, and they're, like, asking him what's going on. And he's like, what do you want me to do? Like, what did you want us to do? Like, let this get out, and there's a global pandemic on our hands. I was like, holy shit.
Right. You almost go like, oh, I kind of wish that we had leadership that lockdown. Well,
one of my notes, and I wrote this in all caps, is the government overreacting, or is it doing the right thing in this movie? Because, like, they fucking nuke a small town, like, ultimately, but...
And what's
the flip side of that? They let it get out, and then millions of people are dead. Like, the whole world ends. Like,
I mean, I guess the flip side of that is that, like, we know that they're wrong because at the end of the film, as David and Judy, if they get out of the crash and they walk away, you know, the that satellite imagery again sees them and prepares to do the same thing for the larger city.
They're going towards Cedar Rapids.
Yes, Iowa, that's it.
Which is like, that's like the big city in Iowa. It's a pretty small city, but...
And if you stay through the credits a little bit, there is, there's like a news report.
Yeah, about shit just going crazy.
Going bad, yeah. The government was not handling it right, like, or there are two arms of the government, one that was trying to handle it correctly, and the other, which is like, well, you know, whatever.
Well, much like in the original, which I think the endings of these two films kind of like show the difference between them. Like, the end of this one they use a nuke to blow up the town, and then, like, in the original, it's just like the crazies end up killing like the main character's girlfriend. But in the ending of the original, also it wasn't contained, and they talk about that in the film too. Like, we don't know if we got to here in time or whatever.
Right.
And at the end, the one military guy has to leave and he gets on a chopper going, I forgot where, to some other city in the country because it's not contained. Which is interesting. It's like, for all their efforts, like, you know, here they went to the extreme and fucking nuked a small town in Iowa, and it wasn't enough because Cedar Rapids is next on the list.
But yeah, it's two very different films, which I think was fun, right? Because when we looked at last month, when we watched The Wicker Man, the remake was, while there's things changed, it's very much the same movie, just worse.
Yeah. Way worse, yeah.
This is at least it's a different thing. Like, it's not necessarily, I don't know if it's better or worse.
We're going to have to decide on this, but I do think that each version here has its own strengths.
And they're both worth watching, I think, is, you know,
absolutely.
We definitely came away last month going, only one of these is worth watching. Yeah. The other one isn't even worth watching for the craziness of that. This does not have that, you know, cult following. As you said, you hadn't even seen the original coming into this. So two very different films that kind of take that same premise, even though this is technically a remake. It's more of a reimagining, I think, of that sort of crisis.
Like, it takes the same idea. Like, this plane goes down in the middle of nowhere and the government has to come in and try to contain the disease, but two very different movies about that same topic.
Yeah. Two very different approaches and different film styles. Eisner's definitely, I mean, obviously it's only 10 years older as well. Just is easier on the eyes.
Yeah.
But I don't know exactly where you fall. I do know where I fall on this. And
let's do the ratings.
Yeah. So where do you fall on The Crazies 2010?
I think this movie's a lot of fun. It kind of came out in that era when we were doing remakes of all of, like, you know, the big old horror movies, although The Crazies, I guess, I don't think was ever a big one. I think it's a worthy remake. I think, you know, it gets away from some of the big ideas of the original, but it replaces that with, you know, movie stardom and a fun ride, you know. So I'm going to give this The Crazies from 2010 a 7 out of 10.
I am also going slightly lower.
Okay.
But only slightly. I do agree that, like, it's a good fun film to watch. Watching them back to back, and maybe that's my issue here. So I watched them back to back, and I watched them, you know, 1973, then 2010. That 1973 movie gave me a whole lot more to chew on up front.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Where 2010 was this is a fun ride, and there is some stuff there, like we said, but. It's not as overt. It is more about the set pieces. It is more about the action. Because of that, I just got just a little bit less going with a 6.
Wow. I thought for sure you were going to go with this one, and we would need to do a tiebreaker.
You did ask on Twitter, though. You asked listeners and
readers
of the feed. Where did the...
We're trying to do this every month to include a poll of people. Ultimately, they might have to break a tie between us, where I say one movie's better and you say the other. But for this month, you know, I asked which is better, 1973 Crazies or 2010. We only got 4 votes, which is less than we got for The Wicker Man's, and they all 100% went to The Crazies 2010. Which leads me to believe
they have not seen that
original. Nobody's seen The Crazies, the original.
That's a shame. Go watch it.
Yeah,
honestly, watch both. Maybe not back to back. Or you know, whatever. They're two different movies. But no, you're going to get two different, fully different experiences watching them that way. One is fun thrill ride. It's a good fun thrill ride. The other is kind of more
substantive. One is substantive. It has stuff to say. It's about things that are happening now, and it's about those things in a serious way. Whereas in the remake, it's like you get passing references to that those issues. Although, one thing about the original, now that I'm looking at our Twitter feed, I don't think we mentioned this, really funny, is the part with the lady with the broom. That got a big laugh out of me. A bunch of these crazies come in and they kill a bunch of people. They kill a bunch of the government people. And they're running off, and they're, like, trailing with them, like, running with them. There's, like, this lady with a broom that's just, like, sweeping the ground.
It's a good, like, as you said, though, because...
It was a film with few, like, gags like that in it. Like, it was a good laugh. Like,
but it's also one of those ones where you don't, like, as you said, you're not really sure who's crazy. Like, even in this one, there's a little bit more of a tell.
Even in the remake here, like, what's interesting about them is they are not just zombies. Like, they can talk to you. They can have a conversation.
Yeah.
They're just a little bit spaced out. Yeah, like.
Yeah, because Russell, as he's getting sicker, like, he's going crazy. But as he's getting there, you know, you kind of see that deterioration. In the original... Though, as you said, like, you can't really tell who is and isn't crazy, except that lady with the broom very clearly has lost her mind.
Yeah, pretty great.
All right.
Yeah, I think, you know, you and I are in agreement here that the original is the winner of this episode.
Yeah.
But both are worth watching, right?
Yes, I agreed fully.
All right, Chris. You ready to hear what we got in store for next month?
I am waiting with anticipation.
Okay. So we went kind of heavy with these first two episodes. A lot of stuff that could, like, correlate to real life where, you know, first we were talking about, like, religious cults going crazy. And then this episode we're talking about people going crazy because of a virus outbreak. I'm going to give us a little break next month, Chris. We're going to go a little lighter. I don't think much to do with stuff going on today, but I don't know because I haven't seen either of these films. We're going to go with a holiday theme, Chris.
Okay. What holiday for July?
The 4th of July.
All right.
And there's not a lot to choose from in the genre for them. So, I did what I could, and these are the two films. We're going to go with Uncle Sam from 1996, directed by William Lustig. Which looks like an Uncle Sam slasher film.
Huh, okay.
And our other film is going to be The Bay from 2012, directed by Barry Levinson, and that one takes place over like a 4th of July weekend. So we got a little bit of an America theme going for the month of July.
The Bay from when?
2012. American found footage horror film directed by Barry Levinson.
I may have seen this one.
I have seen neither. I have no idea what to expect. They're both somewhat well-known directors. Barry Levinson directed Rain Man. And Uncle Sam is directed by William Lustig, who he did Maniac from, I think, 1980 or whatever, as well as the Maniac cop films. So. He's actually got a bit of a known following in the horror community, although I've never heard anything about Uncle Sam. I remember seeing the box art when I was a kid at Blockbuster, but can't say I ever dived into Uncle Sam, Chris, so it's going to be fun for us to check that one out.
I have not heard of this one. I like the zombie-looking Uncle Sam on the poster I am looking at.
I'm excited.
It's going to be fun.
Oh, by the way, it looks like Uncle Sam was written by Larry Cohen, who is another big horror director. He did, like, the stuff. It's Alive.
Yeah.
There's an actual pedigree to Uncle Sam, but fuck, I always just thought it was some straight-to-video trash, which it probably is, but... I'm excited to find out.
Yeah, we will see which is the best 4th of July.
Hell yeah. So
it'll be fun to get away from remakes and
yeah, that too. And just thinking about how fucked the world is now, because I don't think Uncle Sam's going to make me think too much, but maybe you never know. I could be wrong.
No, and it's funny because I picked the crazy specifically because of the 2010 version, remembering it was fun and having a good time with it. And I had seen the original, and I remembered it being, you know, more military driven and more character, you know, work that way. But I didn't remember it being as it was, and maybe that's just because of the situation we're in. So
yeah. No, I mean, yeah, like I said, it hit different now. You're gonna look at it differently.
Yeah.
It looks like The Bay was also produced by Jason Blum, so that would have been in one of his earlier films. Right. So I didn't know anything about The Bay. I don't know anything about either of these movies. I'm excited to dive into this 4th of July horror for the month of July.
Sounds fun. And we'll be back next month.